is a WOR special program, Ulster Update 1982, an examination of the problems in Northern Ireland. Here is the news director of WOR Radio, Lou Adler.
A trip through Northern Ireland, the Republic of Ireland, and Great Britain in search of right and truth about what is referred to as the Troubles can be a sobering experience indeed. Listen to some of the voices of contention.
We believe that peace is based on a departure of the British government and British troops. If that can be done peacefully, then we will take that option. If it can only be done by force, then force is what we will use.
Every time our nation has gone a-whoring after Rome, its greatness has decayed.
As far as I'm concerned, that's what I think sink.
Catholics have got nothing against Protestants. But Protestants are brought up to hate Catholics.
I am totally, absolutely Irish. I don't have to go out and murder them to prove that I am Irish.
If the British got out in the morning, there would be peace. Absolutely peace. No problem. There would be peace forever in a man in Ireland.
They would wipe the bloody IRA. And not only the IRA, but the Catholics. And ordinary, decent Catholic people would be shot.
Any efforts to try to work towards a solution which would create one island, as it were, is just not possible.
That's only a small sample to illustrate the diversity of opinion and the deep emotions that attach to the various perspectives involved in this complex and important issue. Earlier this year, WOR newsman Ted Fury and I visited Northern Ireland to produce a report that would bring us all up to date on the continuing violence and the bloodletting and the prospects for an eventual solution. We talked to scores of people representing virtually every point of view. We read, we listened, and we watched. Each fact, each answer, each impression raised new questions. One reality did emerge, however. Virtually no one we spoke to sees any realistic hope of an early solution. And few will predict even an eventual end to history's longest and most persistently violent conflict. Our trip really began at London's Heathrow Airport, a modern citadel of amiable pandemonium. Travelers bustle through crowded reception areas and along seemingly endless passageways. Languages from around the globe echo about the cavernous concourses. Passengers in every conceivable state of fashion, from blue jeans to burnouses, from colorful saris to somber pinstripes, jostle to and from the loading gates. A veritable banquet of sound and color. But there is a corner of this vast airport, a cinder block building away from the confusion and cacophony, where colors are muted, conversation is hushed, and you immediately sense you've come to the gates of another world. On the departure boards, it is listed simply as Gate 49. It is the departure point for the Belfast shuttle. Armed guards and a private security team scrutinize every passenger, every piece of baggage. There are no automated baggage systems, no perfunctory checks at Gate 49. Each piece of luggage is opened and thoroughly inspected in close proximity to its owner. Carry-on baggage is forbidden. Women are allowed to carry a pocketbook or purse, but only after it's been searched and all questionable items removed. After we passed through the security point, we stopped and watched some of our fellow passengers go through the same procedure. British soldiers returning from leave to duty in Northern Ireland, elderly women, and an infant, all submitted to a complete body search. Once on the plane, we had the opportunity to reread some material sent to us by the Hotel Europa, one of only a handful of hotels still open in Belfast. The Europa is one of the most bombed structures in the world. Some 50 explosions have rocked the Europa since the late 1960s. Visiting journalists have referred to it as the bomb blast arms. One piece of literature begins, "Dear guest, thank you for staying with us on your visit to Belfast. As you're probably aware, there are certain factors and conditions in this province which can be difficult for visitors to understand and appreciate. Emergency evacuation procedures are outlined. It is most unlikely but possible," the document goes on, "that we may have to evacuate the hotel." As we drove to the hotel from the airport just north of the city, we had to clear three checkpoints. The police in Northern Ireland, known as the Royal Ulster Constabulary, the RUC, wear deep green uniforms and bulky blue bulletproof vests. And unlike their colleagues in England, they carry automatic weapons. In most instances, the RUC officers are backed up at the checkpoints by British soldiers in full combat gear, carrying machine guns. Present at many of these checkpoints are also armored personnel carriers, Centurions they're called. The faces of these men are grim. They've come to know that one moment off guard could cost them their lives. The Hotel Europa is surrounded by a 9-foot-high fence topped with barbed wire. motor traffic is controlled by a steel gate, which is raised only after the hotel security officer is certain it is safe to do so. Pedestrian traffic into the hotel is shunted through a guardhouse, where a body search is conducted. The streets of Northern Ireland still bristle with the trappings of war. Barricades, roadblocks, armored vans and trucks, and mean-looking men with guns are all part of the daily scene in the six counties that make up this most troubled corner of the United Kingdom. The backbone of the armed presence is the British Army. It was called into Northern Ireland in mid-August 1969, ostensibly to assist the Royal Ulster Constabulary in quelling sectarian violence. The troops stayed, and they're seen by many of those who favor union with the Irish Republic as the prime obstacle to peace in Northern Ireland. The man who has the power to remove the army or to regulate the number of troops in Northern Ireland, British Secretary of State for Northern Ireland James Pryor, says the army is needed to prevent the Catholics and Protestants from engaging in a sectarian bloodbath.
I think you would have a totally intolerable situation of murder and massacre. And I don't think that anyone in the United States or anywhere else should be under any illusions about the attitude of the majority community towards the minority community, or from that matter, the need for the British troops to be there in the role of an umpire and a policeman. We are gradually building up the police force. We are doing everything we can to get things back to normal. We are reducing the number of troops as and when we can.
Pryor has his supporters among the Protestant population. A businessman from Belfast, a Protestant businessman, says the British Army in Ireland is there for protection of the Catholic minority.
There would be a holocaust if the British troops went out. They're just as bad boys as the Protestants, paramilitary as they are in the IRA, and there's twice as many of them. They would wipe the bloody IRA, and not only the IRA, but the Catholics. An ordinary, decent Catholic people would be shot.
I talked to a Catholic student in Dublin on the campus at Trinity College who agrees with the basic reasoning of Pryor and says American politicians who call for departure of British troops simply don't understand the problem.
When I heard President Reagan say at one stage he called for an immediate withdrawal of the British troops from Northern Ireland, well, I mean, it'd be pandemonium up there if they withdrew at this stage, certainly at this stage. So it's not as easy as saying Britain shouldn't be there, Britain should be there. The fact is they are there, and until such time as everybody from every single faction gets down and sits around a table, and this hasn't been done so far. I mean, you might have three or four parties represented, but each party hasn't been represented, you know, at one table. I think until such time as that happens, there won't be a solution in Northern Ireland. I, for one, believe that Britain shouldn't be there, but I think I'm mature enough to say that I wouldn't sort of call for an immediate withdrawal because that wouldn't be feasible.
The leader of the pro-British Unionist Party in Northern Ireland, Harold McCusker, says a gradual British Army withdrawal is probably the best solution. The Unionist Party also feels the presence of the Army serves to keep violence down. But according to McCusker, Northern Ireland need not always have to rely on British soldiers.
If they left in a climate of bitterness and recrimination and rising terrorist violence, then I think one could have fairly massive communal violence. But if they go on leaving as they presently are, surreptitiously, being withdrawn quietly by the British government and replaced by local forces, namely police and police reservists and the Ulster Defence Regiment, then I think it's possible to reduce the number of regular army personnel on the ground in Northern Ireland to very small figures, and certainly nothing like the 15 or 16,000 that there were just a few years ago.
The Provisional Sinn Féin Party, a supporter of the Provisional Irish Republican Army, although itself a legal party, says the presence of the British Army is the cause of the current state of violence. Joe Austin, Provisional Sinn Féin chairman in Belfast, told us many people are confused about cause and effect.
The IRA are a symptom of the British presence. They're not the logic for it or the reason for it. The IRA, for instance, during the mid-60s, were an organization that was almost completely defunct. It reorganized as a result of attacks directed at the nationalist population by loyalists and by the RUC. And those attacks are well documented. There is proof that that was the case. There's proof that the IRA was almost out of existence. So the IRA reorganized as a result of the British presence and in opposition to it. From 1970, the IRA had been involved in two prolonged ceasefires, formal ceasefires, ceasefires agreed with the British after negotiation with the British, one in 72 and one in 74-75. None of those ceasefires provided the formula for a British withdrawal. And it's that withdrawal, and it's in the presence of British troops in Ireland, that is the reason for violence.
A Catholic businessman who favors union between Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland says most people really want the British Army to go home. The violence, he says, is the result of the presence of the British Army. I asked him if the conflict had religious overtones.
No, it's not religion at all in any shape or form. It's purely the presence of a third party outside Ireland involving itself in Irish affairs and perpetuating the divisions. If the British got out in the morning, there would be peace. Absolutely peace. No problem. There would be peace forever and a man in Ireland. You wouldn't hear Ireland mentioned again except it was a land of saints and scholars, culture, peace and quietness.
To understand Northern Ireland's present, one must study its past. To go into it in detail here would be impossible, for it would mean a report of several hours, time we simply don't have. Suffice it to say that it's a history fraught with violence, oppression, prejudice, tragedy. It began with the invasion of Ireland by the Normans in 1170, an invasion that led to the total subjugation of the Catholic island by Protestant Henry VIII in 1530. Lapsed a spell until after the British defeat of the Spanish Armada in 1588 and saw one of the most terrible and complete military repressions of all time when Cromwell invaded in 1649. His 15,000-man force over a period of 9 months perpetrated a virtual massacre of Irish Catholic resistors. Earlier, King James I had imported settlers in Ulster from England and Scotland, early in the 1600s paving the way for the Protestant majority that now exists in the north. War broke out again 40 years after the Cromwellian crunch, and William of Orange took over the British throne when James II was deposed. In 1689, James II raised an army in Ireland he hoped would regain his crown. That aspiration ended at a famous Battle of the Boyne River just north of Dublin when James was defeated by the English army. The battle ended on July 12th, and it's celebrated to this day as Orange Day, and Orange men throughout the land, the Protestants, marched to the strains of what is almost the Orange anthem, "The Sash My Father Wore." Its words typify the clannish attitude of Ulster Protestants and their opposition to Catholic and Republican goals.
"Now you look after me, old boy, and I'll look after you, and we'll keep the old flag flying, the old red, white, and blue. Our cry was no surrender, no republic we will join, and it will always be as now Daria from Mandaboy. Sure it's old, but it is beautiful, and it's colored."
As the 18th century dawned, the last of military resistance to the throne of England disappeared. Soon were born the infamous penal laws, laws which severely punished Catholics for being Catholics. They outlawed the practice of the Catholic religion, prohibited Catholics from buying land, owning firearms, or owning horses valued at more than £5. They also required that a father bequeath all of his property evenly among his sons, unless one of the sons decided to convert to Protestantism, in which case the law said that son would become the only heir. In 1641, Catholics owned 59% of Irish land. By the middle of the 18th century, they held 7%. There were other Catholic uprisings to follow, one in 1798, a brief and unsuccessful foray that left the rebels with no more than their dead and wounded, and some songs in praise of their futile effort. One of them is called "The Rising of the Moon." It describes the clandestine gathering of a troop of Irish irregulars prior to a dawn engagement with the English forces.
"Out of many a mud wall cavern, eyes were watching through the night. Many a manly heart was throbbing for the coming morning light. Murmurs ran along the valleys like the banshee's lonely croon, and a thousand pikes were flashing by the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon."
The 19th century saw continued flare-ups of sectarian violence and continued but unsuccessful attempts to gain freedom from English rule. These struggles paled, however, against one of the greatest European tragedies of the century, a potato blight and subsequent famine, which began in 1846 and lasted until 1851 and resulted in the death of 1 million Irish people. Another 1.5 million migrated to the United States, Canada, and England. One description of the horror of the famine comes from a journal of Nicholas Cummins, a magistrate from Cork who visited the village of Skibbereen on the southern coast of Ireland. Tommy Makem, the Irish composer and singer, reads a portion of that journal.
I shall state simply what I there saw. On reaching the spot, I was surprised to find the wretched hamlet apparently deserted. I entered some of the hovels to ascertain the cause, and the scenes which presented themselves were such as no tongue or pen can convey the slightest idea of. In the first, 6 famished and ghastly skeletons, to all appearances dead, were huddled in a corner on some filthy straw, their sole covering which seemed to be a ragged horse cloth, their wretched legs hanging about, naked above the knees. I approached with horror and found by a low moaning that they were alive. They were in fever, 4 children, a woman, and what had once been a man. It is impossible to go through the detail. Suffice to say that in a few minutes I was surrounded by at least 200 such phantoms, such frightful specters as no words can describe, either from famine or from fever. Their demoniac yells are still ringing in my ears, and their horrible images are fixed upon my brain. My heart sickens at the recital, but I must go on. The same morning, the police opened a house on the adjoining lands, which was observed shut for many days, and 2 dead corpses were found, lying upon the mud floor, half devoured by rats. A mother, herself in a fever, was seen the same day to drag the corpse of her child, a girl about 12, perfectly naked, and leave it half covered with stones. In another house, within 500 yards of the cavalry station at Skibbereen, the dispensary doctor found 7 wretches lying unable to move under the same cloak. One had been dead many hours, but the others were unable to move either themselves or the corpse.
It should be noted that during those 5 years of famine, English landlords continued to export wheat, barley, cattle, sheep, and pigs to England, while they ousted Catholic tenants who could not pay their rent. So in a strict sense, there was no famine, simply a failure of the potato crop, which was the staple of the rural Catholic poor. Food existed. It simply did not reach large segments of the Irish Catholic population. Little boys and girls were often found starved to death, their bodies in roadside ditches or bogs, their mouths turned green from attempts to stem their pangs of hunger by eating grass. By the end of the 19th century, England seemed to accept the reality of a more even-handed treatment of its Irish subjects, but the spirit of rebellion and independence was growing in Ireland. And on Easter Monday, April 24th, 1916, Patrick Pearse and a small band of supporters seized the main post office in Dublin, and from its steps read a proclamation to a largely uncomprehending crowd of onlookers. The Irish actor Milo O'Shea reenacts that scene.
Irishmen and Irish women, in the name of God and of the dead generations from which you receive their old tradition of nationhood, Ireland, through us, summons her children to her flag and strikes for her freedom. We declare the right of the people of Ireland to the ownership of Ireland and to the unfettered control of Irish destinies to be sovereign and indefeasible. The long usurpation of that right by a foreign people and government has not distinguished the right, nor can it ever be extinguished except by the destruction of the Irish people. In every generation, the Irish people have asserted their right to national freedom and sovereignty. 6 times during the past 300 years, they have asserted it in arms, standing on that fundamental right, and again, asserting it in arms in the face of the world, we hereby proclaim the Irish Republic as a sovereign, independent state, and we pledge our lives and the lives of our comrades in arms to the cause of its freedom, of its welfare, and of its exaltation among the nations.
The leaders of this rising were captured before the week was out, and they were put to death. And that was a big mistake. It was the executions that were the eventual undoing of the English. Alive, most of those who occupied the post office were seen as vandals and hooligans. Dead, they became martyrs and heroes of the new rebellion. For the next 5 years, the Irish Republican Army fought running battles with the British Army, the police, and a paramilitary unit of Englishmen known as the Black and Tans. Support for the rebels came also at the polls. The rebel Sinn Féin Party, prior to December of 1918, held only 7 seats in the British Parliament. The Nationalists, or pro-British party, held 68. In those parliamentary elections, Sinn Féin won 73 seats. The Nationalists, 6. The Sinn Féin boycotted Parliament and named its representatives the government of the Republic of Ireland. Home rule for Ireland was only a matter of time. Various acts and proposals were considered and rejected. Finally, a treaty, a form of compromise, was tentatively agreed upon. The ancient province of Ulster would be stripped of 3 counties that would have meant a province of about equal Protestant and Catholic population. Those 3 counties, Donegal, Cavan, and Monaghan, were included in what was to become the Irish Free State. The gerrymandered remainder, the counties of Down, Antrim, Londonderry, Armagh, Fermanagh, and Tyrone, with a population ratio of 2 Protestants to 1 Catholic, became the province of Northern Ireland. In 1937, when the Constitution of the Irish Republic was put into effect, Article 1 of that document stipulated that Ireland would be free and independent of any foreign power, in effect, removing it from the British Commonwealth. Article 2 claimed that the national territory of Ireland consists of the whole island of Ireland, its islands, and its territorial seas. Article 3 said that pending such reintegration of the national territory, the Constitution would apply only to the 26 counties of the Republic. And so the Republic of Ireland was born. But at that same moment, the seeds of violence and strife were sown. Thousands would die. Thousands more would be mutilated and crippled. And still, 2 contesting groups, 3 including the British Army, continue to fight and die. The issue is the same today as it was 800 years ago, nationhood. Americans see the conflict in Ireland as a Catholic versus Protestant issue. News reports coming out of the North refer to violence by the anti-British factions as Catholic violence. But the Irish Republicans, especially the more militant among them, feel that placing the troubles in a religious context detracts from the nationalistic, territorial struggle they are waging. And there's little evidence to suggest that the Irish Catholic minority in Ulster does have any particular bias against Protestants. But that cannot be said in the reverse. There has been a clear historical pattern of discrimination and repression by the Protestant majority aimed at Irish Catholics, not because they are Irish, but because they are Catholics. If there is one man who typifies to the rest of the world the intransigence of the Protestants in Northern Ireland, it's the founder of Martyrs Memorial Presbyterian Church in East Belfast, Reverend Ian Paisley, a member of Parliament and leader of the ultra-conservative Ulster Democratic Unionist Party. Paisley is unashamedly anti-reunification with Ireland, anti-Catholic, and anti-Pope. His sermons are textbook examples of the feelings of die-hard Orange men.
And if I should no longer climb these pulpit stairs in coming days to preach these truths for which I have contended all the years, the 36 years of my ministry among you, let me put upon you all a solemn charge that if any man should walk up these steps and stand at this desk and attempt to dilute the Bible Protestantism for which this church is built. I lay upon you the solemn charge to heed and hear him not, but tear him from the pulpit. Cast him out from this building, and let this building always be a sounding board for the Bible only.
In a recent sermon, Paisley drew a parallel between attempts at reconciliation between the Church of England and the Catholic Church and the invasion of the Falklands by Argentina.
Every time our nation has gone a-whoring after Rome, its greatness has decayed. But every time this nation has reaffirmed its Protestant principles, this nation has prospered. May God get us back to old-fashioned Bible-believing Protestantism.
Paisley continues to oppose any sort of rapprochement between the Church of England and the Catholic Church, and by extension, union between Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland.
By God's grace, let us be strong in the Lord and in the power of his might. Let us cry on the ramparts of the church, no peace with Rome, till Rome makes peace with God.
It would be a reasonable assumption that Paisley talks only to a small group of Protestant extremists. Many people, even in Northern Ireland, believe that Paisley's congregation is made up of swaggering bully boys and toughs. But a Sunday visit to Paisley's church shatters that vision. We found the parishioners to be very middle class, well-dressed, prosperous-looking, friendly to strangers, and looking every bit like any congregation in this country. Paisley's demagoguery, however, is by no measure universally accepted. Harold McCusker, leader of the pro-British Official Unionist Party, is a political enemy of Paisley's Democratic Unionist Party, despite their commonality of objectives. McCusker says Paisley could be a liability to the cause of continued union with England.
He, in many ways, represents to me the unacceptable face of unionism. I do not believe that the Ulster Unionist position has got to be articulated and argued in sectarian terms. And I don't want to confront my political opponents always on the basis of those arguments. And I don't believe also that political arguments have got to be bellowed out at fourth-term gill strength. Whilst he is a strong advocate for the Union, and whilst I don't doubt his commitment to the Union or to Northern Ireland, I sometimes feel that he does more to damage the Union than to strengthen it.
When we drove to the West on our trip through Ulster, we spoke to a group of Protestant businessmen in Londonderry who dismissed the rhetoric and the aims of Ian Paisley.
I have no more regard for the right-wing Protestant people than I have for the IRA. Ian Paisley is a disaster. He's a bully. He talks too much. He bullies everybody. The sooner Ian Paisley goes and looks after his flock and becomes a man of God, the better for the Protestants and the Catholics and the North of Ireland. We were just saying that in our strata of life, a Protestant and Catholic doesn't matter all that much. In the shipyard, it does, because they hit each other's guts right down to the working class area. Now, Paisley will add to that, will fan that the flame of that. And very often, he's the only one that is talking sense in some instances.
I know an awful lot of what are called working class. They're the salt of the earth. But they believe what Paisley tells them.
Those businessmen, successful pharmaceutical distributors, may disagree with Paisley on one level, but they do see Catholics as different and appeared to contradict themselves when it came to answering charges of broader discrimination.
They are getting the same advantages as anybody else. There's no difference in money, opportunity, anything else. The Catholics probably in the poorer areas, maybe that is why they are unemployed. But I think the Protestants probably are more industrious.
The Protestants are more industrious?
Yes.
They breed a bit more, you see, the Catholics do. They could outbreed the Protestants before very long.
One of those men assured us that religion is not at the base of the troubles.
I have Catholic friends. They are not worried that I'm a Protestant. They're not interested in religion. It's not a religious war.
At one point, we talked to a young Scot, a Protestant, who's now a supporter of the Catholic Republican movement. He says politics and religion are totally intertwined on the Protestant side.
It's political, but it manifests itself in a religious fashion as well. I mean, Catholics have got nothing against Protestants, but Protestants are brought up to hate Catholics. And that's the way it is. I was brought up a bigot. I was brought up to hate Catholics.
The Provisional Sinn Féin, one of the most pro-Republican, anti-British political groups in Northern Ireland, insists that from the Irish point of view, religion is not an issue in the conflict.
The Irish struggle is not a struggle directed at the Protestant people. It's a struggle directed at achieving liberation geographically and psychologically for the Irish people. It is a struggle that will give to the Irish people the right of self-determination, not take from it, which is the case at the present time. Therefore, all of the people involved, all of the Irish people, have got the right to take decisions that affect all of their lives. And that's why I make the point, and we made the point to the British, that a convention needs to be set up that will safeguard the interests of all of the people, minority groups, majority groups, ethnic groups, religious groups. They all have to have the right to sit down and discuss the formation of a new Ireland.
As we heard before, one of the prime areas of discrimination against Catholics is employment. Before the decline in shipbuilding, the Harland and Wolff Company in Belfast was one of the prime shipbuilders in the world. Although the Catholics in Belfast accounted for about 35% of the population, they made up only 5% of the workforce. We drove by those shipyards with a Catholic businessman who had some thoughts on employment and discrimination.
We're situated, used to be one of the biggest shipyards in the world, where the Titanic was built. And when the Titanic was being launched to defy Jesus Christ to sink it, it was sunk. The Orange defied Jesus Christ to sink the Titanic, and he sunk it for them.
This is a mainly Protestant area, right?
Completely. Completely Protestant area that I were entering into. And this is why the excuse they put up for the shipyard being completely a one-sided employer was that they said it was the geographical situation, that it was built, it was there in the middle of a completely Protestant area, and which naturally would say that the great majority of the shipyard workers would be Protestants. But it was only an Orange order. I mean, unless you were an Orange man, you wouldn't get working in there. And that's it.
On the other side, when the DeLorean plant was built in a Catholic area, didn't the Catholics complain about being discriminated against there, too?
Well, again, they put up the excuse that the Catholics were unskilled and that the Protestants were more skilled than they were, and they were entitled to get the jobs. And that was it.
As we've said, many people inside and outside Ireland view the violence, especially the violence carried out by the Provisional IRA, as a sectarian issue. One Protestant sees the existence of the IRA totally dependent on the support of the Catholics.
The Roman Catholic hierarchy and the Roman Catholic population will stop giving succor to the IRA. And when they stop that, the IRA are finished because nobody wants them. The Catholics don't want them, the Protestants don't want them. They are the gutter snipes.
Despite that view, which is prevalent in Northern Ireland, there is little real evidence to support any hard links between the IRA and the Catholic Church. In fact, most Catholic churchmen are in stern opposition to the Provisional IRA. The IRA has been harshly criticized for savage attacks on civilians. IRA bombs have hit crowded restaurants, stores, and pubs, killing and maiming hundreds of innocent people. The IRA maintains it's involved in a war, and it says in war, civilians are injured and killed. If it is a war, it's a war of terrorism in the classic sense. Terrorism, says the dictionary, is the use of terror, violence, and intimidation to achieve an end. But violence and terrorism are tactics of both Irish Republican and Loyalist extremists. Although in recent years, most of the violence against civilians has been put at the doorstep of the IRA, the IRA claims the British Army is guilty of most of the violence. Dr. Joseph Hendren, a physician, a moderate Republican, and a spokesman for the Socialist Democratic and Labour Party, the SDLP, says although he is working for a united Ireland, he condemns the tactics of the Provisional IRA. Violence, he says, is not a route to unity with the Republic.
Be as Irish as you want, be as British as you want. I am totally, absolutely Irish. I don't have any aspiration to be Irish. I am Irish. I don't have to go out and kill and shoot fellow Ulstermen here who happen to be members of the Royal Ulster Constabulary who are policemen or members of the local British Army unit here known as UDR. I don't have to go out and murder them to prove that I am Irish.
The IRA, says Hendren, commits needless violence, both against the Loyalists and also against the residents of Catholic ghettos.
The violence perpetrated by the Provisional IRA has has been quite sickening all down the years. They make all sorts of excuses that they're shooting at the British Army. The massacre of Le Mans restaurant, where many people were burned to death. They say they want to destroy property to cost the British government money. Why did they pick on a Saturday night when that place was crammed with ordinary men and women out for enjoying themselves on a Saturday night? If a young boy breaks into a shop, this is wrong, of course, it's juvenile delinquency. On an ordinary court in Belfast here, he might be put away into some remand home or whatnot. What did IRA do? They kneecap him. They have him lame for life. I have patients of mine who will never be able to walk again because of the violence of the IRA. It is gross and massive intimidation.
The practice of kneecapping was initiated by the IRA as a punishment for crimes committed by Catholics in Catholic ghettos. The IRA argues that crime in Catholic areas is not dealt with by the police. Kneecapping, according to the IRA, is the only way to prevent crime in Catholic neighborhoods. Hendren says the majority of Catholics and anti-unionists do not support the IRA.
As long as I have breath in my body, I will never allow them to say that they are the representatives of the minority, that they got their mandate in 69 or 1916. They go to the polls, and what happened to them in the Irish Republic when they went under the name of Provisional Sinn Féin, they were annihilated. And that's what will happen to them here.
And what of the Provisional Sinn Féin, the political arm of the IRA? How do they see themselves and the violence? Joe Austin, Belfast chairman of the Provisional Sinn Féin, says there are a number of realities which IRA opponents must consider.
The IRA historically have their base in Ireland in opposition to the British presence in Ireland. The violence in Ireland all stems from that presence. The central theme for violence in Ireland is the British presence. There have been negotiations, there have been demands upon the British, there has been sort of ceasefires, there have been all of the logical arguments put to the British about their presence and the logic of their presence in Ireland. They have refused to listen to it. The IRA, the Irish people, have taken the only means that at the end of the day are available to them. If tomorrow morning negotiation could bring about a British departure, then the IRA would call a ceasefire and they would negotiate, as they have done in the past.
Austin says, as the Sinn Féin sees the current situation, there are two options.
We are committed to providing a lasting peace in Ireland. We believe that peace is based on a departure of the British government and British troops. If that can be done peacefully, then we will take that option. If it can only be done by force, then force is what we will use.
But what about the Irish Republic, the nation of 26 counties, which has a constitutional imperative to secure union with the six counties of the North? How does it view the IRA? Michael Collins, a spokesman for the Irish consulate in New York, says the existence of the IRA is a disaster for diplomacy.
There's a perception that any political progress or any progress that has been made or what is perceived as progress has been the result of the IRA and their activities. That's not true. I mean, the basic political developments that have taken place in Northern Ireland, the more positive ones, have been generated by civil rights movements and by the legitimate political parties in Northern Ireland, like the Social Democratic and Labour Party. There is a misconception or an impression that violent action has brought about progress. The only thing that violent action has brought about in Ireland is retrenchment, the deaths of over 2,000 people and over 20,000 people injured. And it has driven people into corners, it's established extremists on alternate sides, it's fed people like Mr. Paisley, and it's generally driven people into situations and corners which a more enlightened political approach, a positive political approach, would not do.
Collins, speaking for the Dublin government, says the Provisional IRA wants more than simply to force reunification of Ireland.
If anybody cares to study what their political philosophy is, I mean, it is a philosophy which is grounded very firmly on Marxist ideology. And in that respect, a very important other point is that the IRA, are not only hell-bent on death and destruction in Northern Ireland and the destruction of the Northern Ireland state, but, I mean, they envisage an Ireland in which the Dublin government, whom they regard as illegitimate, should also cease to function. I sometimes wonder in the United States whether people generally appreciate the broader dimensions of the IRA. I mean, they tend to focus very firmly on the militaristic or paramilitaristic aspects of their activity and ignore the basic political philosophy which is behind it, which envisages an Ireland basically where they would see an ending to the activity of the Dublin government and its replacement by some form of left-wing Marxist-socialist structure in which they would be the core political voice.
The British Secretary of State for Northern Ireland, James Pryor, agrees with Collins on that point.
Not only are they dedicated to the removal of the British and the destruction of the Constitution of Northern Ireland, but they are equally committed to the destruction of the Constitution of the Republic as well. And they look for a united Ireland, one island, which is a totally socialist republic, in a manner which would be totally unacceptable to the South.
The IRA scoffs at the labels assigned to it by many of its opponents. Joe Austin says he's heard many labels over the past 11 years.
We have went through a number of propaganda thrust by the British. We were 1970 fascists. We were 1974 mafioso figures. And they invented a whole elaboration of the IRA, having Cadillacs owning massive houses and all of that. And that was a public projection. While that projection was being promoted by British politicians, the IRA seized a British Army assessment. The British Army said the IRA were a committed guerrilla force who would be in existence while the British Army were in Ireland. There was no personal motivation for personal gain, that the commitment was a total commitment, and that anyone who joined the IRA or joined the Republican movement who had grandiose ideas about becoming rich or becoming powerful or becoming popular soon left. And that in fact is the case, because the IRA represent to its members and the Republican movement in general hardship. I mean, people are on the run. There's every possibility you'll go to prison. There's every possibility you'll be the victim of an assassination. Your family suffer. You don't have money. You don't have a job. And all of those things are as a result of being a Republican.
Secretary of State Pryor also spoke with us about the charge that the provisional IRA is getting arms from Libya and from behind the Iron Curtain.
There is some evidence, of course, that various governments which support insurrection, such as the Libyan government, have played some part in increasing terrorist activity in Ireland, including the supply of arms, including the training of people and explosives and so on. We have no direct evidence that the Soviet government is involved. On the other hand, I think that it is pretty clear that where Western society and Western ideals can in any way be attacked, the Soviets will not be far behind.
Provisional Sinn Féin Chairman Austin says the charges are a mix of rumor and fact.
We're told that we're getting weapons from Libya, from China, from the Soviet Union, that the Americans are orientating. We were told a fortnight ago that the real organizers of the IRA are in fact the CIA. The CIA, Libya, the Soviet Union are very strange bedfellows. Now, I think the logic of that suggestion is that the IRA are badly equipped. I mean, that can be seen by their weapons. That they, like anybody who wants to buy guns, will buy guns from anybody who sells them.
And about the charge that the Soviet Union is a silent partner in the IRA campaign, Austin issued something less than a categorical denial.
I can't see any logic in the Soviet Union supporting a struggle in Ireland. I mean, what would be the personal gain? Our politics are completely opposed to the Soviet power bloc. We're opposed to what they stand for. We're opposed to what they do. We're opposed to who they do it on. We're in support of the people who are on the receiving end of Soviet aggression. What would be the logic in the Soviets supplying their enemies? Because that, in fact, is what we are.
Money and arms do find their way to Northern Ireland from the United States. One of the principal organizations raising money for use by pro-Republicans is the Northern Irish Aid Committee, NORAID. NORAID spokesman Martin Galvin told me many untruths and distortions are created about his group, but he says NORAID serves open aims.
Our purpose is threefold. Number one, we raise funds which are used to support the families of Irish political prisoners, both in the north and south of Ireland, through Ancum and Cara in the south of Ireland and Green Cross in the north. These monies are used on a weekly basis to support the basic necessities of those families whose breadwinners are imprisoned. Number two, we work in this country to build an awareness of the nature of the conflict in Ireland. That conflict exists because British rule exists in Ireland, and British rule is based not only upon military force, but consciously using religious divisions to divide the people, to divide Catholic from Protestant, divide the Irish people in order to continue British rule. And lastly, we work to build support for free and independent 32-county Ireland as the only type of Ireland which can belong equally to all Irish men and women, regardless of religious differences or any other differences. We feel that that is the only type of Ireland which can ever know peace after 800 years.
But Harold McCusker, leader of the pro-British Unionist Party in Belfast, says he's convinced NORAID raises money to buy guns.
It's now recognized as an agent for the Provisional IRA. It's not engaged in collecting money for benevolent purposes. It's engaged in collecting money and getting arms for terrorists who are killing many innocent people in Northern Ireland and in the Republic of Ireland, for that matter. And I think I'm encouraged by the fact that over the past 12 months, the authorities in the USA, have come to identify this group as being the agents of terrorists, and it would look as if the forces of law and order in the USA are getting on top of them as well.
Secretary of State for Northern Ireland James Pryor also says NORAD fosters continuing violence.
I think they certainly add to the responsibilities to that mayhem by sending money, because there's no doubt about it that a lot of the money does find itself into the hands of the IRA and for the purchase of weapons and other things. And we warmly welcome the steps that have recently been taken to try to prevent that happening. But the message that one has to get across to America is that Britain is there in a, as it were, law and order role to try to keep the peace and try to get some initiatives going towards a peaceful solution to the problem of two communities who for many years now have found it impossible to live together.
Martin Galvin again categorically denies that money raised is used to buy weapons or explosives.
No Irish Northern Aid funds are involved. Irish Northern Aid monies, if they leave this country, go to support the families of Irish political prisoners. If they're used here, they're used for something more dangerous from a British vantage point, to make more and more Americans aware of the nature of British military rule in Ireland, and that is something which builds antipathy for British rule, support for freedom for all of Ireland.
Despite the denial of NORAD involvement in weapons trade, Galvin says NORAD supports the aims and the tactics of the IRA.
We believe that the Irish people have the right to struggle against the violence which the British use and have used for more than eight centuries in order to rule them. What is going on in Ireland is legitimate struggle against British military occupation. We point the same arguments that Francis Pym is now using in this country to justify military force in the Falkland Malvinas Islands, and say that if the British, if in fact that they have a right to resist aggression in the Falkland Malvinas, as they say they do, and certainly the Irish people have the right to resist British military occupation in the north of Ireland, they have the right to resist the system wherein the British use religious differences to divide in order to rule the whole area.
James Pryor, British Secretary of State for Northern Ireland, says a solution can be worked out, but he says two things are necessary: time and an end to the violence.
We are supplying Northern Ireland with a great deal more money per person than we are able to give to people in Great Britain. British troops are in Northern Ireland to seek to keep the peace between the two communities and to defeat terrorism. They have suffered great losses. We don't keep our troops there for the hell of keeping troops there. They're there in the interest not just of the people of Northern Ireland, they're there in the interest of the people of all Western society. And we're grateful for the understanding that we have from leaders in the United States, and we are trying to move forward in any way that we can. But this problem has remained with us for 300 years, and it's not going to be easy to solve. But please have a little patience and a little understanding, and stop supplying to these spurious organizations money which is used to maim, kill, murder innocent people.
As Pryor pointed out, Britain is spending a lot of money, about $3.5 billion a year in Northern Ireland. Clearly, a lot of that is going for the support of security forces. But the money also goes for social welfare. In some areas, unemployment is as high as 60% among Catholic males. But unemployment is high throughout the province. The violence and neglect over the past dozen years has resulted in a deterioration in the physical structure of the major cities, and large parts of Belfast and Londonderry look little different from the South Bronx. Michael Collins for the Government of Ireland says if the six northern counties were to become part of an Irish Republic, huge infusions of money would be necessary.
After 800 years' presence in Ireland, at the time of British withdrawal eventually, we would not envisage it to be a precipitative withdrawal. We would expect them to help in a constructive way towards the creation of a new Ireland. And that would obviously involve some form of continuity in financial assistance, perhaps in the short term. Also, we would look to the European Economic Community, of which we are both members, and who would clearly be anxious for some form of settlement in an area of the community which, to put it mildly, is rather unique in Europe. There is a member state, two member states, and there's this conflict situation as between them over the Northern Ireland situation. And thirdly, you have the America. The potential and the prospects of financial assistance have been indicated to us originally by President Carter and subsequently expressed by President Reagan, that in the event of some form of a solution in Ireland, there would be some form of assistance available from the states.
But the Secretary of State for Northern Ireland, James Pryor, has a different view of the future of Northern Ireland.
What we seek to do is to move towards a greater degree of self-government, which of course involves Catholics as well as Protestants, but which can only come about slowly and methodically given the great polarization of society over the last 10 years.
According to Pryor, the basic status of Northern Ireland will not change. Northern Ireland, he says, will stay British.
We think that there has to be a gradual development of a greater degree of responsibility in the province itself for the affairs of the province, that Northern Ireland has characteristics which are different from other parts of the United Kingdom. Although we believe that the future of Northern Ireland is very much bound up with the United Kingdom, and that any efforts to try to work towards a solution which would create one island, as it were, is just not possible with the very deep divisions and prejudices of the last 300 years.
Sinn Féin has heard that statement from British Secretary of State Pryor, but continues to demand a British pullout. Belfast Sinn Féin Chairman Joe Austin says there's only one way to stop the violence.
We meet the following demands of the British. One, they give a declaration of intent to leave. Now, the time factor involved can be negotiated, but the intent must be there. Two, that a convention is convened of all the people involved in the conflict in Ireland, North and South, Republican and Loyalist. That convention formulates structures of government that are workable for a limited period of time. Then a government is elected from the electorate of Ireland. Ireland's problems are 32 county based. We don't have a problem in the north and no problem in the south. The problems that we have spill over to the south as they spill over ultimately to England, and those problems can only be resolved when the British have left. We can't resolve the problem that the British create until the creation of the problems has gone.
Martin Galvin of Norraid, a native of this country, says history, 800 years of history, shows that peace can only be restored when Ireland becomes a nation of 32 Irish counties.
There is a solution. The British want to put forward the view that there is no solution. The London Sunday Times did a report some years ago. It was published in this country under the title of the book Ulster. And they said, very rightly so, that the state itself was the first and the biggest gerrymander. That has been the continuing basis for conflict. And under that state, the British have taken a position that if you're a Protestant, you're going to be loyal to British rule, you will get a privileged status in housing, employment, every aspect of citizenship. They're the only ones who have ever known political power. If you're a Catholic, the answer to you is British troops on the street, the use of the courts against you, utter discrimination and pressure to emigrate. That type of state will never know peace. The British are simply using the sixth county to try and create some sort of improper justification for them to remain. They simply want to remain in the area until the British leave, until we can have a state that belongs to all Irish people, regardless of whether they're Protestant or Catholic. We won't have peace in Ireland.
In his powerful novel, Trinity, which mingled fiction with historical fact, Leon Uris wrote a brief scene and dialogue that in its own way may have said more about the roots of the Irish problem in the North than is possible to put into several hours of debate. The character, Lord Arthur Hubble, the Earl of Coleraine, is lying on his deathbed, talking to his son and heir, Roger, who will inherit the title and the property and the responsibilities of the Protestant stronghold in Ulster. Uris put these words in the old man's mouth. He said, "I give you the legacy of colonists. After 300 years of attachment to the homeland, with all the feelings of inferiority that are aroused by looking back over the shoulder, sometimes wistfully, sometimes defiantly, but always, always as an outsider. We are as a stranger to those who sent us here. We are strangers to those whom we have usurped and exploited. And now, we are strangers to ourselves." A visitor comes away from the two Irelands with a swirl of images and impressions, such as the Easter Sunday parade in the Falls Road area of the Catholic section of Belfast. 80,000 people and more lined the route to the Catholic cemetery for a ceremony honoring those who died in Ireland's wars against England. 80,000 people and not one policeman. The only security forces visible circled overhead in two British helicopter gunships. The following day, Easter Monday, a parade in Protestant East Belfast drew a small army of security forces, police and soldiers with rifles and machine guns posted on virtually every corner. Our first view of the city of Londonderry, Derry if you're a Republican, from across the River Foyle, the city seems to reek of sullen desolation. As you turn onto the bridge, a big billboard promises rewards of money for information regarding murders and bombings. A bright, soft spring day on the green of Trinity College in Dublin. Young Irishmen whose fathers or grandfathers may have fought the British early in this century now want nothing to do with the troubles 100 miles to the north.
In my opinion, I think it's the majority that counts, and the majority want to be British, so let them be British. I don't really care. As far as I'm concerned, let the bloody thing sink.
Union with the north, they say, would just mean more trouble. Judging by the attitudes of the young men we talked to, Republicans in the north have little support among the middle class of Dublin.
Because, I mean, you're bringing in a million people who don't want to be part of the country, you know? And you're also bringing in, you know, they've got massive unemployment and, you know, just wouldn't be, I don't think it would work out at all.
Do you look on the people in the north as Irish or British?
I suppose they have a right to be whatever they want, you know? Apparently most of them want to be British.
That young man echoes the official policy of the British government. The majority of the people in Northern Ireland favor British rule, so Northern Ireland will remain British. The official policy of the government of the Republic is reunification through diplomacy. If the voting patterns in Northern Ireland are any indication, the majority of Catholics are also in favor of reunification with the South through negotiation. And a small but violent faction in the North says it is willing to resort to force of arms, terrorism, and conflict to force an end to the British presence in Northern Ireland. A solution? No one really sees one. Only echoes of 800 years of contention.
We believe that peace is based on a departure of the British government and British troops. If that can be done peacefully, then we will take that option. If it can only be done by force, then force is what we will use.
Every time our nation has gone a-holing after Rome, its greatness has decayed.
Catholics have got nothing against Protestants, but Protestants are brought up to hate Catholics.
I am totally, absolutely Irish. I don't have to go out and murder them to prove that I am Irish.
If the British got out in the morning, there would be peace. Absolutely peace. No problem. There would be peace forever in a man in Ireland.
They would wipe the bloody IRA, and not only the IRA, but the Catholics. And ordinary, decent Catholic people would be shot.
Any efforts to try to work towards a solution which would create one island, as it were, is just not possible. With
the nation once again, the nation once again, and Ireland long a province be a nation once again.
Our cry was no surrender, no republic we will join, and it will always be as Nidaria from and the boys. Sure it's all right.
A special WOR news report, Ulster Update 1982. This program is researched, reported, written, and produced by Lou Adler and Ted Fury. Special production assistance by Jack Franks. Technical assistance by Barney Beck and Bob Iorio. Narrated by Lou Adler. Special thanks to Tommy Makem for contributing his talent to the reading of description of the potato famine. This is Bruce Elliott. Questions or comments regarding this special WOR News report should be sent to WOR News, 1440 Broadway, New York 10018.